Big transfer news today.
Who's moving?
Me. To the couch. With Domino's best deal ever since they just added stuffed crust.
Any pizza, any toppings, now with stuffed crust for $9.99.
It's a long-term contract with no release clause.
Only $9.99? Yeah, that sounds like the move. I'm heading straight to
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6/15 through 7/26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings, 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. On the track, my car's look is everything. But today, I'm talking about more than just paint schemes. I'm talking about my favorite games at Chumba Casino. Check out exclusives like Stampede Fury and my own King Croc Fury. It's just as wild as my car looked in Texas. With over 200 games and new ones weekly, play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 18, Episode 27. This week we heard Bob and Alex Campbell, fellow educator, catch up for a fun conversation. Alex and his students were subjects of the amazing Murder 101 podcast, and now Alex and his students just released a book, Driven by Rage, Fueled by Diesel. And they are the subjects of a great new docuseries on Amazon Prime called Murder 101. This episode has raised a lot of questions from listeners, and today we are sans Janet, but Bob and I are going to dive into all of that. But before we do that, I'm going to drop one quick spoiler alert. Bob and I are probably going to talk a lot about the docuseries as it came out the day we're recording this and we both binged it. So make sure you catch up on that. But before we get into all this, do we have any housekeeping?
No housekeeping that I can think of that we have going on right now, other than Janet's not here. She was at a con this weekend, had some travel issues, so she wasn't able to make it. Our format's going to be a little different today. So because we're recording this on Monday, the show just aired yesterday. We didn't have very many questions, but we do have like three really good points that people made that are kind of like generating discussion. So there's basically, we have three listener comments and they're all regarding the education system and they're all kind of coming from different angles. And I think, and I'd like to spend some time talking through all three of those. So what we're going to do is before we do that, Zach and I are going to talk about Murder 101. You know, Alex, his work, the interview, and the docuseries, which again, we both binged today. And then we're going to move on to those three comments. And so it'll be kind of a discussion more than anything about our education system and some thoughts in that nature. So, first and foremost, interview wise, what do you think about Alex on the show?
It was great to catch up with him. You know, he's such an interesting guy.
Yeah.
So it's so much fun to continue to hear what they're working on. The whole idea that they've created this book out of...
The book is crazy to me. It still is crazy to me.
And I love that they just had so much information. They're like, we don't know what to do. What are we going to do with it? Let's just put it together in a book.
So a couple things. One that didn't make the show, and I told them we'd circle around to it if we got time. We end up not having time. But you'll appreciate this because you were into this for a little while. So Alex is a power lifter.
Yeah, He talks about that in the docuseries a little bit.
A little bit. So we're friends on social media, and I saw just a couple months ago, he just bench pressed 500 pounds.
That's wild.
Yeah. And I don't know how, he's older than me. He's a little older than me, but yeah, that was like a huge achievement for him. Something that he was like working towards. So he's like doing all these different things. And yeah, I'll tell you this, when I watched the series today, I was so relieved as an educator. Right. So like I said, the book thing, like them writing a book, I'm like, who are these? Like, one of two things is happening. How does he have the most amazing students and dedicated students in the world?
Right.
Or do I just suck as a teacher?
Probably both.
Could be both. I could get my students to do it. Like, we could do that. Yeah. But I'm just, I was, as he's explaining that, I was like going through in my mind, like what a struggle that would be with like the real actual human beings that I teach, mm-hmm. right? Like all great kids, amazing. You guys all heard them on the Underestimated podcast. They're amazing. They're amazing young adults, very talented, very dedicated.
Right.
But even that, like I know all their personalities
mm-hmm.
and I know like if I tried to get that whole group to like all work together to write a book, it would be very, very, very difficult.
I think the way that I look at it too is you have to understand too, like you are working with a very limited amount of time with these kids. I understand it's been a few years now, but truly yeah. it's been a limited amount of time where Alex has been on the same project since 2018.
Yeah.
They've been able to expound on all these things that they've been working on.
Well, he and I talked off air quite a bit afterwards, and we talked like he's on our advisory board, so we talk a little bit here and there too. But a lot of it is it's less, I think, that they've just been on this project so long, because he does make changes to that.
Yeah,
every year.
And I guess I hate to say it's that he's been on this project, because the intent wasn't to create a project.
Yeah,
it was to work on this, but they've continued to build and build and build.
Right, but I think the bigger reason he's so successful is more so that he learns things as far as how to operate the class.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, because as we said, he's like every year, like I'm doing something, I'm like, well, that didn't work very well, and then he makes an adjustment,
right?
You know, and then he makes an adjustment. So he's had 8 years, 7 years of like trial and error and figuring out what works and doesn't work. Plus, he knows the kids. You know, he's had them for a long time. It's mm-hmm. just really, really impressive. But when I was so relieved as I was watching it, because if you guys haven't watched Murder 101 yet. You know, the documentarians were in his classroom for a year, just filming everything.
Right.
And when I saw like the kids interacting in the classroom, I'm like, oh, those are my kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, oh, it's not, because like I had in my mind, like these are perfect children. Whereas like, were they like, Sir, Mr. Campbell, we would like to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
We shall organize this and write. Like, that's what I'm picturing in my mind. I'm like, how is that possible with a bunch of, but like you see like the documentarians did a great job of like, catching some of the, there's not any big conflict, but mm-hmm. Different personalities, the conflict. And for me as a teacher, like I see the kid in the corner of the room that's not doing anything, mm-hmm. and I see the kid that's making the smart ass comment that's probably not, he's probably not taking the class as seriously as these two over here that are taking it right. seriously. And Alex is having to juggle all those things, and mm-hmm. he does a great job of it. But I don't know, for me, like as an educator teaching a very similar class, it was like such a relief. I'm like, oh, that, so okay. So you have like you have the same shit.
Mm-hmm.
You're just better at it than me.
Well, yeah. I think the other side of that too, in my opinion, what you just said is thinking about it, is Alex's class is a psychology class, right? Sociology class, and they set out to investigate. That was their sole intent, was to investigate.
Right. They weren't making media.
They were not trying to make any content based off of it. They were just set out mm-hmm. to investigate that. Whereas with your class, you're still doing this investigative journalism class, but that's part of this class.
Yeah.
So you are having to take a different route pretty quickly.
Well, and I've learned from that, partially from my own trial and error, partially from my conversations with Alex.
Mm-hmm.
And then some from watching the show, like I'm going to change because like I have teaching standards I have to hit
mm-hmm.
and that includes writing scripts and creating content and editing. Like they have to do all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I ran my class the same way he kind of ran his class at the, at the very beginning, he said, let's look at this case, right? Mm-hmm. Where I was like, well, let's everybody, research cases, find something you're interested in, pitch it. Let's form into groups and do all that. So every group started at zero, which I think would have been great if what they were trying to do was just investigate the case for the year.
Right.
But because we had to like create content also, I'm looking at this year, we're going to do things a little bit differently. And based on literally the conversation I had with Alex after we got off that interview, I've mentioned that kind of our intention is to do an MMIP case this year.
Okay.
We've got a couple of students that are part of our local tribe that are interested in. Essentially, I want to start having some meetings with the tribal community over the summer,
mm-hmm.
find a case that they want us to investigate and start getting some background so that when we come into the school year, instead of saying, let's all figure out what we want to do, it's more like what Alex did, which is, this is the case. This is what we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll give us more time to. Because what ends up happening, and it's amazing my kids do as good as they do at it, is like you end up not doing everything It's like I'm teaching all these investigative methods. We're teaching behavioral analysis. We're teaching how to file FOIA requests, but I'm also teaching how to organize, outline, write scripts, record, edit, all these things. And because it's so fast, because we're doing it all at once, like I can't really focus on any one part of it because we're always having to move on to the next part of it. So I think we're going to change the way I do things a little bit this year too.
I think the one, again, I'm just putting this out there, spoiler, because here it comes. I think a really interesting thing in the docuseries that they just put out was the idea that he really pushes to not be content with the answer, right? Yeah. So there's this whole, the whole first class is they're talking about the redheaded murders. They end up calling it the Bible Belt Strangler. Mm-hmm. And they find all these victims. They find all these victims. And Alex never allowed them to be content with two things, with it being finished, you know, until everything is clear. Being finished, but also to question everything. And throughout the course of the documentary, they realize one of these victims is more than likely not a victim.
That's my favorite scene of the whole series.
It truly is. And the idea when they start to come to the conclusion and then they go visit the dump site and they realize that this is not plausible based on everything else they know. Yeah. That was a really powerful moment in that whole documentary. Like, I know you said it was your favorite part. That, for me, too, it was an amazing part.
It was really awesome for me for a lot of reasons. One, I like that you captured because that gave you, because people who don't teach high school, I don't think, so. I mean, parents of teenagers have a pretty good idea, but they're a different animal when they're at school. If you don't teach high school and you're not in that environment, you don't really get a great insight into like the emotional capacity of these kids and like how much they truly, like I see it all the time with my kids, like how much they genuinely care about these cases they're working on and the reactions they showed of the students, which, you know, all that happened was, is, you know, the TBI agent is, you know, basically shows them, you know, this theory you guys had, it's not possible. Right. And so like on paper, like, okay, cool, let's move on to the next thing. But watching those students when they were like they were so upset, they were crying. They were, it was like devastating to them. And it's like, I don't even know if they could tell you if it's like, this is my read on it. It's like, is it because we put all this work in for nothing? Is it because, oh, I was so sure and now I'm wrong? Is it we got to go back to zero? Is it, I thought we were going to, we were going to solve this murder for this, to bring justice to this person, and now we're not. It was probably a combination of all those things, but like to see that reaction, like that teared me up because like I could picture there's five of my students that I know would have had that exact same reaction to hearing that because they just care that much.
Yeah. And bravo to Alex for taking them to the scene.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize until I got in this journey how much actually visiting one of the scenes really matters to really see how things evolve. You talked about it early on in the Haman Lee case based on where the body was placed and based on a theory you had. And you're like, this is where this makes sense, where the body
didn't make any sense on a map.
Right.
To me, like that dump site made no sense on a map. Until I went and drove it.
Yes.
And that's how I kind of determined what direction I think that the killer was coming from.
And then I've heard the same theory. I want to say it was Jim Clemente talking about the Casey Anthony.
Yep.
And it's the same concept of, it doesn't make sense where the body was disposed of until you go see it in person. And you're like, it makes perfect sense now.
Yeah.
You know, you and I went and stood, you'd been there before, but in West Memphis, we stood at the Pipe Bridge.
Yep.
And when you really see everything, the way it's laid out, it puts a whole different perspective in your head. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's those little things. And so bravo to Alex for actually creating this little field trip and taking them to that scene so they could visualize it themselves.
Yeah. And it is huge. Cause like I said, you and I went to the West Memphis 3. Now you would know, cause you heard me talking about it for all the time before that. But when you were there and I was able to show you, okay, here, there's a house. Here's the Pipe Bridge.
And
you're like, the crimes, the bodies were found right there. And you realize how you can't understand how close they were until you're standing there.
And that was you taking me there. And I felt like I was very well versed in the case.
You were. Yeah.
So somebody that's very well versed in the case still couldn't comprehend it until they got there.
Right. Yeah. That's why I wanted you to say that. Anybody that I'm ever down there with, I'm like, you need to go see, because your imagination of where you think how remote these boys were when they were killed when you stand there and realize you can literally throw a rock from the backyard of this house to where those bodies were found,
mm-hmm.
like, it's crazy. Same thing with the Haman Lee, and that was the one where, you know, the state's whole theory of where, you know, Adnan put the car over here and they came from this way. None of that made sense on a map, whatever. When I went and drove that route through Lincoln Park, I was like, this makes no fucking sense.
Yeah.
If they were coming from this way with the body in the car, like, there was a good spot, 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 there was a good spot. This is the worst spot. This makes no sense. But then when I turned around and came from the other way, as if somebody was at a hotel up by the school, if they came from that direction, it's like, oh, there's lights, there's houses, there's lights, people can see, there's houses, then you turn this corner and bam, there's a turn off and a perfect spot. Like, that makes sense now.
Mm-hmm.
Now it makes sense if you come from this way. But you would never know that unless you were there.
Yeah.
But the other thing, the other part I loved about that was, one, he took them there. I loved being able to see, like, the true guttural reaction of the students, but also the lesson that Alex taught them from that. You know, when they come back and they're like, okay, you had a theory, and there's another time in there too. I don't want to give too much of it away where they get new information, they have to adjust their theory.
Mm-hmm.
But he's like, you know, he says is our job to come up with a conclusion and try to find evidence to fit the conclusion, or is it to always take in new information and adjust our theory? And so, like, it was a lesson in them, like, not to have cognitive dissonance, not to get locked into something when there's new evidence coming in. And so, like, he taught them that. And that's a hard lesson to teach people.
Right.
If you don't believe me, go on social media on any site like ours where you're talking about a case, and there'll be people that are just so dug into their beliefs and they refuse to accept new information. Like, he taught them that lesson, and we got to see that happening. You know, it was really cool.
And I think that's a great time for them to learn that, as their brains mm-hmm. are still developing, they're still understanding things, they're still learning. They're learning how to learn.
Yeah.
That's a great time frame for them to learn something like that.
And he taught them, I mean, again, I can't praise Alex Campbell enough for everything that he's doing at that school and for these kids. Despite all the media stuff that's out there, as an educator, he taught them that incredibly difficult lesson of being willing to accept you were wrong because of new information. And he taught them that lesson when they were at an emotional peak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these kids were crying. Like, they're crying. They're devastated that what they thought they had figured out, they just learned they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And he took that moment to teach that lesson to them. And that, if you know anything about, you know, learning domains and like, it's actually like that will stick with them forever.
Mm-hmm.
There's the, you know, the affective learning domain is when you take in information during a time when you're really feeling like peak emotions, and it commits things to deep long-term memory. That's why, like, if you're ever not doing comedy, but when I was, you know, my comedy style came from my presentation style when I do speaking engagements, when I'm teaching,
mm-hmm.
you know, from a platform, why my style is always to be very serious, joke around, be really impactful and sad and up and down. I'm intentionally trying to take the audience through an emotional roller coaster because I know the amount of that information they're going to retain goes up by like 90%.
Wow.
If they're feeling strong emotions while they're learning it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, like, I've always, like, tried to present that way because of that. And I guarantee you, Alex knows that too, because it was like, that was a time where your instinct would be like, it's okay. It's okay. You know, and comfort them or whatever. But he's like, hey, what did we learn?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's always asking these kids. What did we learn? I loved when the scene, I'll let you talk about the one that, because it'll probably make you cry.
Well,
but it was super impactful, but I liked the scene too. And I didn't catch, because I was busy while I was watching all day, but they had on poster board or whatever, like easel board, where they had written, and I assume they wrote at the beginning of the year, I am capable of, and they all wrote things.
Yeah.
And he was like pointing like one of the kids, but I'm capable of like getting good grades and doing well on tests. And then they all had to write in the same color at the end of the school year. They had another paper that said, I am capable of, and they had to fill it in again. And he was showing one of the kids had written at the beginning of the school year, I am capable of getting good grades and passing tests. And that same kid at the end of the year said, I am capable of changing the world for people.
Yep.
And it was like, that, I mean, that's a huge, huge statement,
mm-hmm.
but he was like, at the beginning of the semester, I'm capable of passing tests and getting good grades is about you.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about, you know, what internal I can do. At the end of the semester, you're not talking about passing tests for yourself. You're talking about what you can do for other people.
Right.
And so it's like, that's the through line, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's like, besides, you know, Murder 101, the podcast, the docuseries, the book, all the attention they're getting is that, you know, if to me, again, as an educator, it's like, he taught those kids to put their energy into, in their care, into someone outside themselves.
Right.
And it's just such an incredible right. lesson.
Really? I mean, taught them humanity.
Yeah.
That's simple. The scene that you were just talking about too, it brought me to tears when it came on. I was just even talking to you in the office about it, and it brought me to tears in the office. So
yeah.
There's a scene, you talk about exactly that in the final case that they worked, and it's the exact victim that we were talking about, that they had changed their mind on who the perpetrator was, all of this. They didn't know who it was. They actually helped identify this girl.
Right. She was a Jane Doe.
She was a Jane Doe. And Alex pulls up an article from 2001 before she was identified that says Jane Doe, girl, you know, skull found.
Mm-hmm.
That is the entirety of the article. And then he goes, now look at this article. And he pulls up an article from 2025. And it says, Tracy Sue Walker, 15-year-old freshman cheerleader. You know, they put a face to her. They put a name to her.
They made her a person.
They made her a person.
Yeah.
Kids did that.
Yeah. And again, you know, the work the kids did is it's tearing me up too, by the way. Yeah. It makes me feel any better. But the work the kids did is so incredible that did that. But again, like I'm looking at, like I look as Alex as a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took that scene, right? That moment
mm-hmm.
where they were devastated because they were wrong. And he turned it into a lesson for them. And then found a way to make them realize what they did was important.
Right. Like and how powerful it was.
They don't make teachers like that.
No.
They don't. You know what I mean? I mean, that's not nothing.
Yeah.
And also, by the way, there's no rule book or lesson plan outline that's going to say, well, just do this. Like, he had to go sit and think. And I haven't talked to him about this because I didn't know that until I just saw the docuseries today. But he had to sit back and think, okay, what do I do with this? Because he knows, as an adult, you know that the work these kids did
mm-hmm.
made a huge difference. But you know, they set their mind, we're going to solve this case, and then they found out, no, we're not. Right. And
right.
So like I can see him as an educator. And you become, at least for me, like I feel almost like a parent to these kids when you're with them for so long.
Yeah.
And you're like, how do I make them understand that they did win? They did accomplish something.
Mm-hmm.
They did change the world. And to figure out that the way to do that is by simply showing them the two articles, one where there's an article about this nameless victim, and then in the new one that there's this article with her name, her background, everything mm-hmm. about her. He had her brother come in and talk about how important that was to him. Like, oh, it's just go watch. We're gonna move on now to the these other discussions because we probably gave away a lot of it. But it's, I mean, a lot
go
of this,
watch it.
This stuff's out there. You need to watch it. It's an experience that everybody needs to have.
And truthfully, I binged it today. Bob binged it today. Very bingeable.
Yeah, three episodes.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
By law, 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
All right. So with that, I do want to move on. A lot of this discussion is about the education system. Mm-hmm. So in our follow-up thread, again, it was super early because we're doing this Monday, but we had three comments. They're all three kind of long comments, but they lead to good conversations. So we have Danielle who's an educator, and she's discussing like the value, because, you know, Alex and I talked about, you know, the things that we're teaching, the way we're teaching, how we should change it.
Right.
So Danielle is an educator, and she's talking about the value of that legacy model and system. And I want to make sure that that point is understood when we talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
And then right for that, Kathy, who is a parent and grandparent who is, you know, put her kids through school and is now kind of raising her grandkids, also putting them through school, by hearing that is making her kind of reassess how she sees the education system, what she thinks the frustration she's had with the legacy. So it's like one's kind of like pro legacy system. Followed up with some great comments about how maybe we need to change things. And then there's a third one. Alex and I had some conversation about AI in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And Nancy had a post about that I want to talk about that a little bit too. So with Danielle, I was going to kind of paraphrase it because it's long, but I don't think I could say it better than her. So I'm just going to read what Danielle said. So again, Danielle is an educator. I really enjoyed this episode. I think these projects are amazing, both for what they teach students and for how they engage students in being active learners and participants in their world. I just want to speak to one small thing, which is the value of having knowledge and not just outsourcing it to technology. There's a fair amount of research out there about how human beings learn, and one thing this research suggests is that we learn more and faster when we have existing knowledge and frameworks to network new knowledge to. It's really difficult to develop skills in the absence of foundational knowledge because our brains are only able to juggle 4 to 6 new pieces of information at once. But we have no difficulty working with a ton of information that already exists in long-term memory. This is called cognitive load theory. If we have to look up 10 pieces of information just to understand a situation, we're not going to be able to effectively learn. But if we have existing knowledge and just need to look up 2 to 3 pieces of information, we can effectively network that knowledge with the old. Knowing the order of the presidents just to know the order of presidents may not be useful, but knowing the order of presidents as part of a narrative of history can help a person understand and analyze, for instance, cause and effect in our present-day political situation, something a person can't really do effectively if they don't already have the historical knowledge and long-term memory. None of this is a knock on project-based learning, but as an educator who reads research studying how we learn, I just wanted to say that learning and possessing knowledge is really important for learning too. So I agree with all that, Danielle. You know, she's basically saying, like, when I was saying, I don't need to know who the 19th president was because I could just ask who the 19th president right. was. But she's saying, but if you do know that, it helps you kind of, you know, synthesize other information because you have all the stuff in the back. And actually, I'm reading some of the, I'm in my my graduate work right now for in education. So I'm kind of studying some of these same things right now. However, mine is in workforce education, so it's CTE learning. So, you know, mine is like acknowledging those, the coursework I'm doing right now is like acknowledging those studies and comparing them to studies on project-based learning and how the two kind of come together.
Okay.
Right? So here's my issue. It's not, we'll take the president example. My issue with the what I call the legacy learning system, right? The way schools work now or have worked for years and years is, you're right. Learning if you just know the order of the presidents,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's kind of a narrative. It helps you understand context when you're trying to figure something else out later. It really is kind of the same thing we were talking about when we were talking about how, like, you know, if when we were talking about AI, which is a whole another piece of conversation, but it's like, well, if this can give me the building blocks, then I can use that to do more advanced thinking on it later.
Right.
But so it's kind of the same thing. If you do learn all these presidents, then you have that information, then you can help to understand context later because you can draw back on that long-term memory. Here's my problem. Our system is not designed. And again, this is, I'm a teacher. Okay. So like, I'm talking about my own profession too here. The system that I work in is designed. It's not designed for you to have the order of the presidents in your long-term memory.
Mm-hmm.
You have a high school diploma.
I couldn't tell you. Yeah.
Could you tell me five presidents ago, right?
I mean, if I really thought about it, probably.
Yeah.
But that's my lifetime.
Right. Maybe not 10.
But not 10. Definitely not 10.
Right. Me neither. You know, I couldn't do it either. Most people can't do it.
Yeah.
Unless they learn like the song. There's like songs to remember it. But it's not necessarily that they're teaching these basic facts, right? I get that. It's how we're teaching it and what we're doing to assess it. So I was in a conference a while ago, and there was a guy that was kind of like challenging the legacy system in this conference I was in. And he asked some other teachers some very difficult questions. One, so let's use the president example. So I said, okay, so I give you a unit, Zach, I'm teaching you, and you have to, you know, you have to learn the order of all the presidents.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to spend a week or 2 weeks, whatever, doing it. When I'm done with the unit, how do I assess whether you know that or not?
It would be one test, whether I can
give you a test, yeah. Right? Maybe it's a test and retest, but we have so many standards mm-hmm. we have to move through. We don't have time to spend a lot of time on it, right? But I'm going to give you a test.
Mm-hmm.
I give the test, and this is what he posed to the teachers. He's like, you give that test, and 80% of your class passes the test. What does that tell you? They're like, well, I did a good job teaching it.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 80% that passed it, the average score was 85%. Some people passed it with a 70, some passed it with 100, average out whatever to 85. Okay. So you have all this data now. What do you do with it? What are you doing next?
No idea.
The answer is move on to the next unit.
Okay.
So the data tells me 1 in 5 students in the class didn't learn the information, can't repeat it back to me.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know it. Of the 4 out of 5 that learned it, on average, 15% of them, or, you know, they didn't know 15% of the information. You know, some of the kids that passed it, passed with a 70%, right? So that means they didn't know a third of the presidents,
mm-hmm.
but they knew enough to pass. So I have 20% of my kids don't know it. And then the other 80% of my students know it to an extent, but they don't know all of it. And then we move on to the next thing. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a way to ensure that, like, we're actually, you know, teaching to the crown, everybody, we're making sure everybody gets the information, they've learned it, they understand it, and we're ready to move on. But that's not how the school system works, because the state gives you this list of standards this long that you have to get through in the course of the year. So I can't, you know, ideally you'd say, well, let's reteach. Let's keep working it. Let's keep working it until everybody gets it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to move on. But that's not reasonable.
Right.
I can't spend 2 more weeks doing this. I've got other shit I got to teach. So my bar is how many, what, you know, I think most teachers, if you give that test and 40% of the students pass it, you're like, okay, I need to reteach this.
Right.
But if 80% do, that's a win. But is it?
This is probably a question or a topic that's going to come up, but there's so many things like that, like the presidents or just things like that, that are all memorization and they seem to lack functionality to me.
Right. That's my issue with all of it is I think the argument Danielle is making and what the research shows about mm-hmm. thinking is valid if students were actually retaining it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my case, I was one of the 80%. I was a 4.1 student.
Not me.
So I took my class where I learned the presidents and I got an A.
Mm-hmm.
I set the curve. Did I retain it? Nope.
Yeah.
I didn't retain it. I don't know how to do it. I couldn't. And it's the same thing with math and different science, you know, lots of different, anything that wasn't like practical where I was applying it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't retain it. So it's like, it's just one of those things. And I'm not disagreeing with you, Danielle. I just, to me, this is one of those things that's like, on paper, those studies are correct. In reality, it is not. Now, if you could find a way, and that's where project-based learning comes in, instead of saying, I need you to memorize all the 45 presidents, but I'm going to have you, like, you know, write a story about the presidents in order. It's got to be factually accurate, right? So now, you may not learn all of them, but you can take a chunk of history, you know, and tell that bit of story where you're like applying it to something. I'm using the part of my brain instead of just like that's like taking in to short-term memory and trying to poke it back into my long-term memory. Instead, I'm using the part that's taking in a short-term memory and processing it into something new.
Mm-hmm.
That's project-based learning. Then now I'm retaining it.
Yeah, that makes way more sense to me.
To me, it does too. That's why I think project-based learning is so important. And that's why, you know, the kind of our discussion about, you know, like there's a huge, and I'm sure you have a high schooler, I'm sure you're experienced. Mm-hmm. I've had 4 high schoolers. There's a big apathy problem with kids, meaning they just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And that question is not just like it's a question that kids do ask constantly. I hear it constantly.
Yeah.
Why do I need to learn this? Why do I need to learn this? And these kids aren't stupid. The problem is, like, we want kids to be smart and stupid at the same time.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's like we want them to be smart, intelligent, great learners, great thinkers. But then when they say, why do I need to learn long division? And I say, well, because someday you might be an engineer.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I mean, that's a fair question from the students.
It is a fair question. Well, first of all, what if they're not going to be an engineer?
Mm-hmm.
Was always the old argument.
Yeah.
The new argument is, you know, if they are like real thinkers,
mm-hmm.
right? They're thinking critically the way we want them to, then they're not going to accept that either. They're like, okay, I want to be an engineer. I talked to an engineer and asked him how much long division he does, and he's zero. They don't do long division. Nobody does long division.
Mm-hmm.
You know, math teachers hate that, and I'm not shitting. I'm a math guy. I'm not shitting on it, but I'm like, so what I propose is what in my mind, what I feel like is like the better solution is, I'm not saying, okay, well, just don't teach him long division. It's just teach him long division in a different way.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Don't be like, okay, this is how you do it. These are the steps. This is the process. We're going to be doing it for 2 weeks, and you're going to have homework every night, and we're going to keep redoing it and doing it, until it's automatic. Mm-hmm. That's how it's taught now, right? Repetition. Whatever the thing is, division is an example.
Just because you can regurgitate information doesn't mean it's useful or that you actually really know the information.
No, because these same kids that learned the long division and got the A, if you ask them a year later, they probably can't do long division either,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's like, what I would propose is say, okay, let's find like where does division matter in the real world? And let's do a project where you need to use division to do it. And you can use the technology that let them use the technology. And I get it. I get what Danielle's saying is 100% right. Is it better if they have the base knowledge? Cause that's what he's here is like, yeah, but they need to understand how it works. The problem is that they actually don't.
Right.
Now, from what she's saying, yes, it's true. And like, if they have that knowledge, it will help them think quicker and better because you can only process so many things at a time. If the you know, for like me back in my day, they don't even do this anymore. We had to learn our multiplication tables,
mm-hmm.
and that was just memorization. But it wasn't just a unit; it was repeated over and over and over for years. Always, you know, there was always these quizzes on the times tables, right? So, like, you know, I know that, you know, 9 times 4 is 54. That makes the process when I'm doing long division or something else much faster because I have that information. The problem is with technology now; it's not a needed skill anymore. And you're trying to convince these kids. So, how do you get the kids engaged? How do you get past that apathy and make them actually care about their education? Because a lot of them just don't. And I mean the overwhelming majority don't care about their education.
I see that every day with my child.
They see it as useless.
Mm-hmm.
And then have you had that, why do I need to learn this conversation?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And not only have we had that conversation with my son, who's now a sophomore, but I felt that way.
Right.
On my end, watching my son struggle with math, you know, I mean, in him not understanding why he needs to know this, and me also going, I don't know why you need to know this. This is not where your life is headed. You know, right. And I don't, not to pigeonhole him, but he's not going to be an engineer. I know my child. You know what I mean? He's not like,
and probably doesn't want to be an engineer.
And he doesn't want to be.
So, to me, the biggest problem is like it all comes from like government above us, right? From like mm-hmm. the state level, where you know, and someone comes from the federal level, you know, where they're like, so now, and this is going to lead us into what Kathy's talking about here in a minute, but like all students have to have 4 years of math, all students have to have 4 years of science, all students have 4 years of this. To me, what is far more effective is like a track program,
mm-hmm.
where if somebody is like, and we kind of have that in Michigan in our schools through CTE. So CTE courses count as a fourth year math credit. So it doesn't take care of all of it, but if you're in a CTE class, you don't have to take math your senior year because it counts as the math your senior year. So that's a little bit of a help. But it's so the kid that, you know, so for example, we have an automotive technologies class. It was one of our CTE courses. These students, they come out of that course ASE certified mechanics. The instructor connects them with most of them the day they graduate, go to work.
That's awesome.
They go to work making $35 to $45 an hour, mm-hmm. you know, and just goes up from there. You know, he's already had students from 4 years ago that are like managers at shops places.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, and the same thing with our machine tool class. Mm-hmm. So so if a kid comes in their freshman year, like, my dad was a mechanic. I want to be a mechanic. I love working on cars. I want to be a mechanic. Great. You have to take 4 years of English, 4 years of math, and you can't take auto shop more than, you know, you can't take it to your sophomore year. Then you're going to take it 1 hour a day because you got to fit all these other classes in. Then your junior and senior, you can take it 2 hours a day, mm-hmm. but you still got to take all these other classes. And there's use in some of those other classes, but some of them there's not.
Right.
It's like if the kid, you know, I just wish there was like a track where you'd be like, okay, the path you want to take is you want to be an automotive technician. Well, then let's put, you know, just like college. Then we're going to put you on a track that leads to that. And we're not going to make you take a bunch of shit that you don't need.
Right.
You know, would be nice. And a lot of it's pie in the sky because I don't know the answer to how you do all that because like you're always balancing all these different standards, but it's changed. And that leads me to, let me read Kathy's point here. Kathy says, I love this episode and it really made me rethink our education system. I've often wondered why we need 4 years of certain classes. When I was in high school, we only needed 2 years of math. Today, you have to have four. Why? If you're going into a scientific field or as a mathematician, then yes. But honestly, we have a whole ass computer in our pockets. Any math we need beyond elementary school, we can use our phones for. I never was quite sure how to answer the question, why do I have to take this class with all six of the kids that I've raised? Because it's required was the only answer I could give. I got pushback from these really intelligent kids wanting to know why it's required. That's when they learned mom, grandma doesn't know everything. She said, that's when they learned mom/grandma doesn't know everything. Ha ha. Raising my second generation of kids is showing me that what worked in the past is no longer working today as far as education goes. Two of the three grandkids have graduated, finished their senior year at home through a program at the school. The last one has been doing virtual since eighth grade. She'll be a junior this year and has almost decided to go in person. Then changed her mind. So many kids today have school avoidance syndrome, partially due to the fear of being shot at school. My grands have school anxiety because they seem to be fine in other social situations. So, yeah, that's the thing. When I graduated high school, we had so many more options.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had, I think it was the same. I think we had to do 2 years of math. Maybe it was three. And there was just, you had all room for all these electives. And they just now have just like bombarded them with all the standards and all these things that they have to take that they don't necessarily need. And I don't. To me, project-based learning is the way to go. Because there was just a thing on our local news channel on WSBT where they were talking about the attendance crisis. And that's a real thing. Now, Bridgman's pretty good about it. At least they were when Bella was there. Because Bridgman was like, if you miss more than a couple days, or if you miss a day and you don't have a parent call in, then you get a detention, you get in trouble.
Yeah, they're pretty on it.
Most schools aren't. My school's not. It drives me insane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had students that graduated, passed, that had 50 some absences in 1 year.
That's wild.
Not a single one excused by a parent. Now, when I was in school, if you missed school and your parent didn't call in, that was called skipping,
mm-hmm.
and you got in trouble for it.
So currently in high school, we have not got phone calls, but with my youngest being in middle school and prior to that, if they weren't in school by 9 a.m., we would get a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't receive those with our oldest, but we still have to excuse them. We still have to call and excuse them.
Yeah.
And it's a problem.
Yeah. And that's a whole different issue. I don't know why.
There's no truancy issues or anything at school?
No, like it's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have meetings about it all the time. Like they're always trying to find ways. So like one of the ways they did was if you have fewer than four absences in a semester, if you have four or fewer absences in a semester and you have at least a C in the class and you don't have to take an exam.
Mm-hmm. We got a letter in the mail because we went on vacation and we got a letter in the mail about our students missing too much school.
Yeah. We had that with Bella too when she got mm-hmm. when she was real sick. It was during COVID time because she had missed too many days.
Yeah,
but yeah, so like that was the plan that they kind of came up with, and it worked to an extent where kids would they'll talk about it openly, like I was going to skip tomorrow, but I've already got four absences. I don't want to take my exam, so I'm gonna come. But then like the question I pose, which again, you know, I'm the new guy and I'm a CTE teacher, so it's, you know, how much people are listening to me. But I'm like, what's the fucking point of exams then?
Mm-hmm.
That's my problem with it. It's like, what is the entire point of, like, I get what they're doing and it's effective to get them to school. But then now how am I supposed to assess their learning?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the whole point of the exam is your summative assessment to assess whether they learned the material. And now you're like, well, if you showed up most of the days and you got a C, you don't have to prove to me you learned anything. and I'm not shitting because they're trying hard to find a solution to get these kids to school. But you know what I tend to propose is make school worth it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like you know, when we have these kids, and I'm telling you, I hear it all the time. When they're like, they won't let us use AI in school. They're like, you know what I do when I go home and I have questions about my homework? If I decide not to use AI and I ask my parents for help because I'm trying to, you know, because I don't want to cheat and don't do it right, my parents get out ChatGPT and use that to figure out how to do it.
Right.
He's like, so when I'm seeing all the adults in my life using this technology and I'm supposed to be learning how to be an adult and they're telling me, you can't use the technology when I know that's how they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it like becomes this. So that's been my thing is if we can move towards more of the project based learning in all the classes, not just in CTE and not completely, but find practical ways. Like, I mean, cause look at what Alex is doing. That's not a CTE class.
Correct.
It's a sociology class. And he was like, how can I make sociology mean something to these kids? And he found a way. And I think like good educators can do the same. I think that they can take everything Danielle said and find a way to make it meaningful to the kids is what I would like to see. I mean, listen, I ended up with this teaching job because of my opinions on this shit.
Yeah.
It literally came about from me sitting around with who's now my CTE director and complaining about the education system. Well, you know, we need to be doing this. We need to be doing this. You know, I had my oldest stepson struggled in school and Simone just said something in the chat too about lifting the stigma of you have to go to college. That's the answer to everything. And I agree. Like my stepson has all kinds of talents. Schoolwork wasn't one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was made to feel, and it kept compounding and getting worse because he was made to feel like, oh, if you're not good at math and science, you're not going to go to college, so that means you're going to be a piece of shit. I mean, they didn't say that, but that was what they That's made awful. Him feel like,
yeah.
Right? And then he just shut down after a while because it was just like, yeah, he just got awful. To be made to feel less than all the time because he didn't want to be college bound. That wasn't his thing.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that like my district is very good about that. That's why we have 6 CTE programs in our yeah. little school is because we're trying to offer paths outside of college. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy.
just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
By law, 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
Anyway, so moving on to the last one is from Nancy, and this is kind of a hot topic. It's such a complicated topic, but I'm just going to read what she said. Nancy said, I was so sad to hear both teachers talking about using AI in the classroom. It's been shown that use of AI decreases cognitive ability, and it's counterproductive to what we want kids to learn, like how to write, how to judge sources, how to think critically, how to be skeptical. The first AI native kids are hitting the job market right now, and they're not doing well at all. It's a poison to society, both figuratively and for what it's doing to us as a society, and literally for what it's doing to our air and water. Right now, it's Sunday night, and there's a huge question about if a senator is alive or his family made an AI picture of him to fool us. Living in a world where it's so easy to make disinformation is horrible for us as people. So I agree with most of what you said, Nancy. And that's why this is such a difficult conversation. There are, let's kind of walk backwards, right? The environmental impact. There's no question about that.
Correct.
I will say this. If I could wave a magic wand and make it not exist, I would wave that magic wand in a second. I do not like it. I don't want it out there.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it wasn't. That said, I don't have a magic wand and it ain't going nowhere.
Right.
Like there's it's not going away. It will not go away. Even most of the people that I know that are the ones that are like on the bandwagon of it's terrible, it's wasting water, da da da. If you talk to them for 2 seconds, you find out they're using it.
Mm-hmm.
Like so many people like are still using it for one thing or another.
Well, and you and I have had multiple conversations that I don't think it's not super secretive that I am very against AI. But if me saying I'm against AI and me being against AI and not wanting to use AI and not what it, that doesn't change the situation that it's out there and it's being used and it's going to be continued to be used.
Right.
And like I have grown to understand it and I have used it without even realizing. I think people don't understand that they use it.
Oh, it's everywhere now.
It's everywhere.
It's built into Google. It's mm-hmm. built into Microsoft Word. It's built into Adobe Acrobat. When you read a PDF, it's built into everything now.
Right.
When you make a phone call to a business, you're talking to AI most of the time. Like mm-hmm. it's all over the place. But yeah, especially for you as like an artist, like it's terrible.
Yeah, that's where my biggest problem with it is the creative aspect of it. Is it being able to do all these things for people that you're taking any artistic ability away from people?
Right.
And it's as a person that makes a living from art, it hurts. It sucks. But there is the benefits to it. I do genuinely see the benefits to it.
So I want to talk, this is not the direction I want to go with this, but I'm curious, like from your angle, I think this is a good thought project here.
Mm-hmm.
So now what AI can't do is tattoo it onto people's skin. Right?
Correct.
So like, we know that part of it.
Correct.
Right? But let's say people, would pay you because you don't do this. You just include it as part of their, like if somebody asks you to create something for them, you don't mm-hmm. charge them to draw the image, right?
Correct.
But let's say you did,
mm-hmm.
because there are artists that do that, right? That they'll charge you a fee to draw your thing, right? So that's part of your business model is you draw things for people.
Mm-hmm.
And now people are starting to use AI to do that and it's starting to replace you. So how do you, if you still want to continue to feed your family, like on a moral level, 100% against it.
Mm-hmm.
But on a practical level, I still have to make money and feed my family.
It is tough.
What do you do with that?
Well, so I think there's a human element that you can't replace in mm-hmm. the arts, in the art world, because there's so many people bring me AI generated images all the time.
Yeah.
Hey, this is what I want to get done. Well, here's the problem, and this is a very niche thing to talk about. Not everything's tattooable.
Yeah.
Imagery wise. And I don't mean because it's not, but like you're creating art that isn't viable on the skin.
Right.
But people don't understand that, mm-hmm. you know, so it does take an artist to separate the two.
Right.
So it is hard to build a career because you do have these people doing this, and it would be easy to lean into AI to design images for people and design things because you could make a profit off of it probably. And people right. do it all the time with other artistic ventures, not just tattooing. But for me in the tattoo world, that's the way I look at it, is that it's like there's still so many things that AI can't do that people do not understand. And that's the hard part, is the education side of it for me.
Right.
And I don't mean education as in within school, but I mean just as like the general
populace. So from like your perspective, where I'm trying to think of from you, and it's not a great example because like you don't need this kind of productivity, right? Mm-hmm. But as an example, like, when someone comes to you, like for me, a lot of the work you've done for me, I'm like, I got this hodgepodge of ideas I want to put together mm-hmm. into a mural of some kind.
Right.
I'm not artistic at all. So mm-hmm. I can't. So I did like one of the ones I did on my leg. Like I used AI to come up with like a model.
Mm-hmm.
And I was and then I had you draw it. But I was right. like, I was like, okay, so using that, this is what I want.
Right.
I could see a world where an artist is like, okay, in order for me to be able to compete, to get stuff turned around as fast as everybody else is, again, it's not really practical, but mm-hmm. in this imaginary world we're in, right? So just think of a graphic designer, maybe as a better example. Right. You know, I could do that where somebody's like, well, give me your ideas. And I can take those ideas, punch them into AI to get a model, boom. And then I can take that model and I can adjust it to make it work, and now you're able to compete by using it. But by doing that to compete, to make the money, to feed your family,
mm-hmm.
you're doing this, you're using this thing you fucking hate.
Right.
That's the struggle.
That is a struggle. It's a horrible struggle. And I still see the struggle of there's people that can use exactly that graphic design element where you said I can punch all this in, create a model for myself to then create it just so I have something to base it off of. That's perfect. That could be a great way to do this, except for somebody's going to undercut it and just give you what they printed out.
Right.
And they're going to undercut your value.
Mm-hmm. It sucks.
Yeah.
It sucks, but there's like, so there's this whole, this is my point is the whole thing is very complicated. We talked a lot about this with like a lot of like podcast logos and people using it to make like covers for their books and things like that mm-hmm. for a lot of artwork. And I was like, you know, for like particularly a graphic designer, I would hate to be a graphic designer right now
mm-hmm.
because there's a human element where a human could do something better than what AI could make.
Right.
But from the business standpoint, the person who needs the graphic design work, who would normally go and hire, I'm going to go hire a graphic designer. I'm going to pay him $1,000. It's going to take 2 weeks and a bunch of back and forth. And they're going to make this logo that I need.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, or I could put a prompt in for free. And in 30 seconds, it's going to spit something out. I can just give a couple more prompts and adjust it. It may not be to the quality of what a human would have made, but I think like those businesses, and we're seeing it. Like I have friends who are graphic designers that are like, there comes a point where they don't care. Even if their moral compass is, I shouldn't be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
At some point there's a bottom line and they're like, this is free. That's $1,000. This is 30 seconds. That's 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden like that job's going away mm-hmm. and there's nothing we can do to stop it. I don't know how to stop it. Like how you stop it from happening.
Right.
So it sucks. Getting back to kind of Nancy's point here, something you said there is exactly my point. So she said, the first AI native kids are hitting the job market right now and they're not doing well at all. Exactly. Because what you're calling AI native kids, those kids were not allowed to use AI in high school. There are no AI native kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like as far like in the state of Michigan, there is one school district, the Ann Arbor School District, that has an AI, they call it the AI Bill of Rights, that has come up with a way to intelligently integrate responsibly AI into the classroom to come up with a balance so they're not taking away learning. They're using it in a certain way because we're kind of trying to model something like that in our school. That's the only reason I know, because I'm in charge of it for our district, is trying to find a way to do this. So I can tell you, like in the state of Michigan, the AI native kids are kids who for the last 4 years or 5 years since AI has been around were not allowed to use it in school. It was considered cheating if they use it in school. And that's my point. Okay. So as an educator, and I don't think this is easy for people to understand, if you are, and I consider myself to be a good educator, I and what I mean by that is I'm there because I genuinely care about helping these kids become young, good adults, right? I want to teach them meaningful, impactful things that they can take in onto the rest of their life. So if you're in that position, the position I'm in, and here's this thing that I hate, but it's the thing that is running the world right now. And now I have to decide, do I find a way to show them how to use it responsibly? Or do I continue to pretend like it doesn't exist? Knowing that if I go that route and I don't let them use it at all, when they get to the job market, they're going to be at a disadvantage. Because the job market, almost every company out there, whether it's, you know, selling parts for cars,
yeah,
or whatever, they're using it in some way. They're using it in marketing, they're using it in graphic design, they're using it in their writing and their memos and their emails. They're using it. And they're expecting people, so that even the older generation that's just now learning to use it, that's in the workforce now, they're starting to raise that bar in what they expect out of productivity because I'm telling you what, industry doesn't give a shit about your moral compass or what kind of thinking people are doing in general. I'm sure there's examples where that's not true, but in general, what they care about, what industry cares about, is productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they're coming accustomed to this high level of productivity because people are using this tool, and then we're sending kids to them to be the next generation of workers, and they don't know how to use the tool except for to say, write me a paper about this, which is where and by the way, that's so freaking easy as a teacher to catch. Like, I know in a second when kids do that, I know in 1 second when I look at it that they didn't write it. And we have tools built into our system because we do everything through like Google Classroom. So like Google has this thing called Brisk where they turn it in. One, there's AI detectors, which work pretty good, but then the kids find a way to try to like trick those.
Okay.
But Brisk, you put it in, it replays them typing it on the Google Doc. Like literally in real time.
Yeah.
I mean, you can speed it up, but it shows like, so like if I read something and I'm like, that's AI, you get a zero. And by the way, I don't let them redo it. That's one of the ways I'm very strict with my kids. I'm like, we work on deadlines. You have an assignment. If you do it and you either don't do it or you cheat and use AI and do it, you get a zero and that's it. That zero stays. That's what you get. No redos. So kids don't play in my class.
Yeah.
But if they start arguing, it's not AI. I wrote that. I'm like, you wrote it? Okay. I hit Brisk and I make them sit there with me and watch it and it'll show it. It'll be like type, 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 paste.
Yeah.
You can watch them do it. You can watch the whole thing. And so then they'll get the, it's because I wrote it on a different doc and then I pasted it into this one. I think, no, you didn't. Yes, I did. Okay. Show me the other doc.
Yeah.
Never one time. Every time at that point, I have every single kid has been like, all right, I used AI.
Yeah.
Like it's easy to detect, but there are ways to use it for processes and things like that. So like my oldest son he's going to his senior year. And he's a programmer. He's in the game development program at Michigan State. So he makes video games. Like he's the Call of Duty, those games you guys are playing, like his college program teaches him how to like write that code, do that artwork, do all like the design, the development, every step of like making a video game. And I was just talking to him a couple weekends ago and he's scared. He's like, there's no jobs. When he started that program had an 82% placement rate. They showed us the stats, 82% of their graduates left their program and went directly into industry and were working, making wow. It's like the number two program in the country for it. Like yeah. They're very good. And he's like, there's nothing. And it's because all these big video game companies that used to be, say there was like a team of like 10 coders working on making a big game.
Mm-hmm.
He said, because you got somebody like that's developing the code, somebody that's writing the code, then somebody who's debugging the code. And there's all these different levels of things you do. He's like, they're using AI not in a way where you're like, oh, AI, write me a video game. The programmers are using AI to say, okay, help me outline. They're using it to like think through the idea, give me ideas about how the game works. And by the way, I agree with you, Nancy. That sucks because that's taking away our human, like, you know, that thought process, being able to think.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is what happens in industry. So he said, you know, they're using it so that that process is getting sped along. And then the coder, instead of 10, they have one. Because that coder can write the code and then they can punch it into AI, when it, to AI to debug it. And they can, they use AI, and I'm talking out of my ass right now because I don't know any of these terms, but I mean, some of the, I heard, he said the word debug and he said the word code and he said, but essentially, because they're able to use artificial intelligence to very quickly, because he's like, there's slow processes. Like when you're writing all this code, like there's parts of it that don't take cognitive ability. It just takes time. Mm-hmm. That's why there was 10 people. But now AI does it for you in seconds and you don't need the time anymore, which means you don't need that many people anymore. So it's not like the industry is falling off or they're having like computers make video games. It's just they're using the AI in a way that it's made a lot of the jobs irrelevant, and the industry, again, they're all about the bottom line.
Right.
So now he's going into an industry where 9 developers from every project that were already there and working are laid off and are all out looking for jobs that have 10 years experience in the field. And now these new kids are coming out of college trying to break into that space. And it's very, so, you know, like he's, his hope is him and like 3 of his buddies or 2 of his buddies that they've made games together. Like they've been working together this whole college, is for them to like start their own studio.
Yeah.
It's basically the only way for them to break into the business is for them to make their own game and publish it or sell it. Yeah. So,
but with that being said, on the complete opposite side of that, and I just literally said that I do not like AI, but on the complete opposite side of that, AI makes it possible for your son to be able to start a independent company and succeed.
Yeah. Yeah. And he will use it. And that's what he said, like, because he was one that was like very much against it, and he's learned to use it and integrate it into things. And so like he's using it for, they've started to like help him develop a business because he doesn't have the education in that, but it's helping him develop a business plan and a marketing plan and the things like that. Like he's like, now he's starting to utilize the AI, and that was part of our conversation. He's like, I've hated this whole time. And I'm real, what he's telling me as a 21-year-old going to be a senior in college is he's realizing that in order to be successful in industry, he has got to learn to use it.
Yeah.
Not just to say, write me a paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point is like, so circle all back, and this is really, we've gone really long, but you know, so what I'm trying to figure out how to do, and I think what Alex is saying is like, if we can find the places where we can use it in a way, teach the kids to use it responsibly. Like here's, you know, don't use it to write your paper for you, but if you're needing help brainstorming ideas about something, or, you know, and don't just use it as Google, right? But like, use it to do tasks that take time instead of cognition. If you can use it to take up those, then you'll have more time to spend focusing on the cognition part. I don't know what that looks like. I don't, and we're still trying to figure all that out. I feel you, Nancy, 100%, and probably all the hundreds and thousands of you that also agree with that. I feel you, but that is my challenge. That is Alex's challenge. I think you guys know me, and I think especially if you watch Burner 101, you will see that Alex is an educator who genuinely, truly cares about doing the best they can for these kids. For teachers like us, it's not as easy as saying AI bad, ban it, because that's doing a that's not helping these kids when they get out of school. So,
right,
that's our chat. It
was a good one.
Yeah, it was a long one. So, thank you guys for tuning in. This week we've got special guests. I have coming on. We haven't heard from him in a long time. Aaron Habel from, you know him from the Generation Y podcast, but many of you, a lot of you probably do know, but if you don't know, Aaron has another podcast called Framed, and where he's looking into a potential wrongful conviction case. He's done several cases where he has done like long form investigation. He just launched a new season. The first 2 episodes are out.
I'm a bad friend. I did not know this.
Yeah, I just saw it on social media this morning. this morning. I opened up to look at for this post for this, and I saw like his post about that. And I was like, hey, and I texted him like, hey, did you just launch a new season? Like, yeah. Do you want to come on and talk about it? It's like, hell yeah. So we got on the phone for a little while. I already talked to him for an hour today. So we'll see what's left to talk about when we actually interview.
It'll be good.
Yeah. So Aaron from Gen Y and Framed will be on this Sunday. We'll talk about that with you guys, hopefully with Janet too, next week. We'll talk to you guys then.
Bye guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham.
Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.